welcome to another episode of Soulful. This is the podcast that reveals everything you've ever wanted to know about sneakers, hosted by myself, Kish Cash, and my good homie, Jason Coles. Yo, Jace, how you doing, brother?
I'm good. I'm great, actually, Kish, because I am stoked about today's episode, because we've got one of the most popular guests from season one coming back. Yeah, the one and only Erin Narlock, who's the head archivist at Reebok. So many of the listeners just fell in love with Erin the first time around that we, you know, we had to get her back. And, you know, to pick up the story from where we left off and take us through probably one of Reebok's most exciting eras. But she's not on her own this time, though, is she, Kish? She's bringing a very special guest with her today, isn't she?
I'm super stoked because the thing is we've got a lot of mutual friends, but Frank the Butcher, better known as Mr. Frank Rivera, who's now at Reebok, has been there since, I think, since 2017, I do believe.
Frank's produced, you know, some of the best collabs, you know, in the last probably 15 years since he's been around. You know, he's done some brilliant things, not just for Reebok, but, you know, with Puma, with Nike. So, yeah, without any further ado, joining us all the way from Boston, Massachusetts. So, Frank, Erin, we are absolutely made up to have you on the show today. I think it's fair to say, Erin, that you won a lot of new fans on the podcast in your first episode, especially with that Midwestern accent.
Thanks. Just kidding.
So, look, as we closed your first episode, we were kind of in the terms of the Reebok story, the brand was on top of the world, really. And there were two things that had kind of become the engine of the company, which was firstly, definitely the power of women. And secondly, innovation. I guess where we are now, kind of in the mid-80s, is it fair to say that those two cornerstones continue to power the brand through the 80s and into the 90s?
Yeah, for sure. I think, so if you think back, 1985, Reebok will go public, and it'll happen during the summer. During that summer, there's this great movie. If you're not familiar with it, check it out. It's called Perfection. It starred Jamie Lee Curtis and John Travolta, right? And it's all about working out. And so that will be top of mind in popular culture. You can look at Newsweek from the midsummer of 85 and see one page. And on the top, it's all about Reebok and women. And on the bottom of the page, there is a very famous basketball shoe, right? Making its debut for men. So there's definitely the fuel of the female force behind Reebok. And I think in the mid 80s, they'll take kind of the capital and all of the gains from great sales and start to invest in technology. And that will happen, I think, when I think back. And I'm sure folks know Paul Litchfield, right? Paul Litchfield and some of the early innovators at Reebok will really step into their own by the late 1980s and really lay the foundation for some of the greatest technologies we have to offer, you know, including the pump.
And we had Clark Kent speak internally, you know, to the internal group during Black History Month, you know, more for my, you know, for my colleagues. And I had an interview similar to this, you know, basically it was a podcast, right? We're just talking about, you know, Clark Kent's experience with the brand and how he come in contact with it and what it meant to him as a young man and you know, running around in the birthplace of sneaker culture. So there's a different level, different metric of measuring value, right? So where does Reebok fit inside of that? You know, and one of the things that he said was, because I presented the same scenario, right? Hey, you know, what do you think about the pump? What did the pump do, right? When you heard about the pump, what was that first reaction? Because, you know, you never know. There's a technological component to it. There's an innovation there, right? That there's a level of appreciation for that. Like Erin has pointed out, right? It really meant something in terms of pushing, you know, footwear forward for the athlete. But what did it mean culturally? And simply, Clark said, if it didn't look good, no one would have gave a shit.
That's it. That's it. And this is why the pump won out against another competitor's
version.
Foray. Their version. Yeah. You know, because the aesthetics was so on point. And then the Michael Chang shoe with the court victory, you know, even though it's a tennis shoe, I'd say it was a slam dunk. Do you know what I mean? Because, you know, it just like, whoa. And what Michael Chang achieved in that shoe was like one of the most incredible feats of athletic endurance, perseverance, and tenacity that I can ever recall in my lifetime. It's phenomenal.
And those are those cultural serendipitous, right? It's like we can't control that. People in the brand, we can't control that. But you have these intersections of energies and accomplishments and the product developments and you know, and not only a product development, you know, designed and struck a tone culturally. So you got all these things happening, just popping, right? And then we look back and we go, wow, when all that shit collided, when everything was present, when it was supposed to be, we have these moments, man, like the pump and the way it entered culture and how it affected it. And an athlete connected with the brand winning such a, you know, such a significant achievement, right? Especially, I mean, there was a lot of factors there. It's just magic.
Totally. I mean, that's when athletics was, you know, the ambassadors behind the brands were sort of like being thrust into the fore even more and, you know, given due adulation for their achievements and the merits. And hopefully that would inspire people to adopt and, you know, follow up through that inspirational example and, you know, go, hey, if they can do it, maybe we can do it. Do you know
that's
what I mean?
It. That's it.
That's brilliant. It's brilliant. I mean, what was remarkable for me around that time, though, is I've seen all these technologies that Reebok was coming out with. I remember ERS and then the Hexalite. And I have to say, in terms of branding, you know, and in terms of the appliance of technology and the amount of different technologies that were in play, I don't think one brand has ever encapsulated those moments in such a cohesive manner, employing all those different elements into the shoes.
Yeah, I think so. ERS is the energy return system. And even if you look back at the ads of that time, it was really, you know, there was a lot of bravado in the way we talked about our technology, right? I think the first ad I saw with ERS is the revolution is over. And that kind of call out, like, hey.
That little wink yep. to little something. Right? Yeah.
And with Hexalite, right? Hexalite lives today. We have the pump for stability. We just talked about the pump in basketball, but it really goes into 10 different categories throughout its life. We see it all over. But we, I think at Reebok also, and consumers can really resonate to the moment where D Brown takes that time to pump up his shoes before he'll go on to win, you know, All-Star Weekend's dunk contest. I recently found out something that I think really impacts the way we remember that is, one, we didn't have all of these different forms of media we can like hop onto and watch and like listen and read a Twitter feed. There was television, right? So you have people kind of watching TV. And then the second thing is, at that time, the U.S. was entering the Gulf War. So the stadium, you know, that space was really regulated and they didn't allow cameras in. So many people who attended that, they couldn't take their own pictures. So what we have is really some of those quintessential frames, and it's framed our collective memory around that event. And I think that's super powerful. And it will be that moment that D takes the time to pump up his shoes that will kind of grab the attention of Paul Fireman and his imagination for what technology will become in the 1990s at Reebok. Yeah. So then fast forward, Instapump, like the performance before the performance, the warm up, right?
Yeah, no, was that, do you know if it was a conscious effort by D to actually go, I'm going to highlight the tech, I'm just going to, it's a little bit of a playful thing, or was he actually seriously, you know, doing that because the shoes were needed to fit around his feet to achieve?
I think it's probably a little of both, right? He demonstrated the technology. He showed people how, and I mean, I was much younger at that time, so I can remember people in class like that sound, right? I don't know anyone else. But I think it was a little of both. And it's definitely something like, to Frank's point earlier, we were just lucky to be there in that moment and be part of that. And today, it really fuels us as we look forward.
It's brilliant. It's a brilliant moment because it's one of those moments that actually percolated through and into hip hop culture. You know, even Big L, you know, put it in his rap lyrics. You know what I mean? And it's just like that moment just became that significant to a vast strata of society across the globe. You know, because I remember that and I was just like, wow. You know, and just see, because
it was validation, right? It was ultimate validation. You know, when D Brown bent over and hit that pump, there was a level of romantic transfer, right? Where it's like it was a piece of rubber pre that moment, and it was a button to, you know what I mean, to your greatest dream.
That's it.
You know,
yeah.
Post that moment, right? Yeah. And that's what it's about, you know, because ultimately this is just stuff made in factory, these items, you know, it's what happens around these items.
That's
that, you know, give it that value. Yeah. So, you know, again, one of those moments where we were there, we didn't mess it up. One of those moments where we let it happen.
Yeah.
And looking back, like you say, you know, it was a brilliant moment, but for no work of ours, the work was to allow it to happen.
Yeah,
you know, in that way.
To wind back just a little bit, because there's so much kind of mythology about how the pump came around. Because I've heard things like, you know, it was like inspired by air pressure cuffs and then like a ski boot. What's the actual true origin story of it?
So I think it's, I'm going to say a little of both, right? So air inflatable air technologies like that have been around for decades before the pump in different applications, right? So if you think of blood pressure cuff, that's one.
Yeah.
And actually we have some prototypes where the team was kind of evaluating different applications of the pump. And one is a cuff and the collar of the shoe. And definitely also in ski boots, right? So thinking about inflating for fit. The pump as we know it is the only patent, and we've had the US Patent Office here given or provided after commercial success.
Oh, wow.
So the concept there was because the technology had been applied in so many other areas, they really had to show how the applying this technology, the pump, the cuff, like the different inflatable chambers in a basketball shoe first was warranted of its own patent. And that's its story. So it's a little of both. Mm-hmm. And we definitely have different prototypes that kind of just look to the making and kind of the evaluating of how to make this technology work. To Frank's point, they were produced in factories. But if you look at and listen to oral histories by Paul Litchfield and Stephen Smith, there was a lot of innovation kinks they had to work through with the pump itself. Like, how do you ensure when you're doing the stitching of the pump ball that you're not puncturing the bladder and making sure that those components work? And at the time, so the pump goes to the market in the fall of 1989, right? So the day after Thanksgiving in the United States is very famous for shopping, and it will retail for $170.
Crazy
so
money.
Wow.
A very expensive pair of shoes, but it will create that success for Reebok. And then we'll go ahead and start to apply pump in other basketball models. So I think of Blacktop, we had one pump, in Blacktop specifically, and we'll also then see it in running and other places.
Yeah,
exactly.
I loved some of the advertising around that time, because you had the famous, was it pump in air out, with, as Kish mentioned, you had Michael Chang, and then you had like Dominique Wilkins, and it was kind of just constantly ribbing that certain brand from Oregon.
Did, one story I remember hearing about though, with the first basketball pumps, didn't the pumps actually get punctured in the manufacturing process? So the guys, the team where you are right now, had to pull out the units and hand stitch the new ones in. It was a colossal amount of pairs as well, right?
Yeah. Yes. So I've heard similar stories from Paul and Stephen that just manufacturing was this really difficult feat. Mm. So they had to check and triple check the models that were delivered. And in some cases, do that kind of work. No, thank you. And thank you to them.
You know, hearing that, I pick up quotes every now and then and I'll put them in my phone, you know. Last week's quote that I caught from Charlie Parker, the jazz great, right? He said, "It ain't magic, just seems like it is," you know.
Yeah.
Right. So it's like, you know, really the goal or the task is to, you know, whatever work it takes, right? Look at the additional work and the, you know, having to restitch things and, you know, whatever it takes. But the experience of it all, when a person experiences, is a fluid experience. It's a, you know, it's a memorable experience. It's not weighed down by any other, you know what I mean, factory issues, right? Yeah. Just like the jazz musician, right? He's just plucking at your soul, but you don't realize he's busted his lip from playing, you know what I mean, 1,000 hours leading up to that moment. So that's what it is. It's like, you know, we land where we land, right? And sometimes, you know, it's again, it's just about staying out of the way.
Yeah, and absolutely.
Getting it done, right? Mm-hmm. And for them to take that extra step. Exactly. Without those extra steps, we wouldn't be talking about it today.
Exactly. You know? And that's one of the reasons why Jason and I started this podcast was to find out the stories behind the shoes. It's like, everyone loves the shoes. They see it on the shelf and they go, wow, and they put it on and they stunt on the gram or whatever. But it's like, what went into that? What was the process? What was the mechanics? What was the perseverance? What was the imagination? You know, how did they come to fruition, basically? And that's what we're trying to explore, you know? I mean, one of the things that, you know, is always remarkable for me around the era and for Jason and I is that although Reebok found its fortune in the US, there was a sort of strict sort of, I don't know, philosophy to maintain the British identity, you know, and the foundation of and the core values of the brand. What was the reason behind that?
Yeah, so when Reebok comes to North America in the late 1970s, at all of the time Reebok existed before that, we never utilized our British heritage, right? It was only when we came to North America, we wanted to call out the fact that we were British. Or had a kind of roots in Britain. And I think the reason why we can kind of go in three different lanes here. One is because the running boom that fueled us to North America had been around in Europe for a whole decade before the United States. So calling out the fact that we were British also brought some prestige and some kind of, hey, we know what's happening in running. And then that was built into the brand equity. That's one. The other, I think of athletic stores at that time, they were open box stores. All of them were open box stores. So if you think about the Union Jack or Canton, right? It is really impressive on boxes. And if you can utilize that in a store setting, you have a visual identity that people can really be attracted to. And also I've heard, right, that you don't have to copyright or trademark that flag. You can just use it. So I think it was also some skillful business decisions like, hey, if we utilize this in the window box, we don't need to pay for its use. Let's go ahead and do that. And even the early boxes, the innovation I think of that they utilized is the bottom of the boxes for women were red and the bottom of the boxes for men's footwear were blue. And I was like, that's kind of ingenious. You don't have to read a box. You can just look at it and visually kind of utilize it.
You know something, right? Yeah. This is an admission. I didn't even know that. I didn't even clock the red boxes were the women's ones. And the blue. I was just like, maybe they were a different category of shoe. I wasn't even looking at it that close. That's genius.
Yeah, it really is. But that the union, so we'll always call back to kind of this British heritage and like making, you know, athletic footwear, but by the late 80s, early 90s, Reebok will clean up the way their shoes look on, you know, their profiles, right? We will no longer have the window box. We will no longer have the Union Jack. We will start to like embroider Reebok and call out technologies, maybe on the heel, like if it is ERS or if it is the pump, right? And we will prepare really for the course of three plus years, we'll prepare our footwear for performance in the 90s by introducing our performance logo, the Vector, right? So it's all very thoughtful in that process.
Wow. Yeah, I remember that. It was the RBK as well, wasn't it? The transition to that.
So RBK is later, right?
Yes,
when
later.
We think of the 2000s.
Okay. So yeah. But the DNA for that moment happened with that.
For sure. And I think that Reebok has pivoted and has been and has introduced itself as a brand in a variety of ways, depending on our consumer, depending on what was moving culture at the time. And RBK definitely represents a very significant era in Reebok.
I think
all those eras innovate on the one previous, right? And I think that in each of those eras, Reebok stands unique at something, right? So I think in the 90s, it was, you know, that language of our product, the language of our marketing, the energy of our messaging, it was all very, very unique, right? But it was a convergence of great product, great messaging, great energy. There was an attitude about it. And that's what that Vector became. And when you see that Vector present on so many uniforms and you know, so many pop culture moments, sports moments in the 90s, you know, it had this personality, it had this attitude, it had this great product that represented it, but it also had these magical moments that it was a part of, you know. So that Vector is not just purely a couple lines or something clever, or you know, it really has soaked up so much of what it means to be Reebok, or what it means to be passionate about Reebok. When people see that Vector, it's just an automatic trigger, you know, that runs down this list of all the reasons why you love the brand, right? It's that's what the Vector became.
Yeah, you needed the icon so, you know, people could instantly identify with what Reebok stood for. And it was brilliant. It looked clean, but it looked aggressive.
Yes.
But then it looked classy.
Yes.
You know, it had multi-dimensions. Yeah.
It had attitude. It has attitude.
Yeah.
All of those things.
For sure. And it is dynamic, right? Mm-hmm. It is like the best icons for sports brands. It's moving and it has direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
I would, and not to be biased. You know, I think we all here are, you know, we know what it is. We might have affiliations or passions, but we can objectively look at these things. It is probably the best of that type of logo mark, right? And I'm talking about from everybody, you know, from ASICS to the Swish, you know, to the Form Stripe, you know, and so on. And just in terms of iconography and design and what it means emotionally, right? It's hard to get better than, it's hard to be better than the Vector in that way.
In terms of branding, just across, even going beyond sports into just like where you're looking at, you know, the icons that you see from different brands, you know, it stands out, it holds up, you know what I mean? It's absolutely, it's absolutely wicked. It really does. And that's a hard thing to achieve.
You can have the Levi's logo, you can have the Pepsi logo, you can have the Apple logo, you can have the Vector. Yeah. Absolutely. All in that same conversation.
It looks like it's moving even when it's still, which for a sports brand, you know, it's probably the only one you can think
it's
of.
It's genius.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know? Yeah, it's so genius. There was even a stadium, right?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's crazy. But I mean, you know, that time that, you know, we're discussing and all the innovations, et cetera, we've had a great fortune to chat to Stephen Smith at length and what he brought to the table in 94, still reverberate. I mean, even when I see the Reebok Pump Fury on someone's foot, I'm just like, whoa, they still look from outer space. This is the thing. Yeah. This looks like it should be in Star Trek and Buck Rogers, but it still looks good. It doesn't look out of place, though. It actually looks now, but future, if that makes any sense.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I'm sorry, I got excited because it starts sort of ringing in my head right where just think about a young Stephen Smith, right, who is pushing boundaries of design, right? Mm-hmm. Now, we look at these things and they become icons. They become things, you know, have celebrated 20 and 30 years, right? But at the time, it was nothing like what was happening. That was part of why Reebok, who, you know, was Reebok that we know and love, they fostered that type of environment.
Yes.
When you want to put a pump on a shoe, what you want to do, like, you know, listen, man, Stephen Smith, he pushes the boundaries. And a lot of those pushes, right, that seem fucking outrageous, like what the hell is this guy doing, have become some of our most iconic, and not only that, the most influential. What he did here has become, has you know, inspired iterations from other brands. It was very much a beacon of like, you know, new, you know what I mean?
It was
like
a watershed beacon moment, of newness. Wasn't it?
It was a shift. Yeah. It was
a watershed moment. Boom. Like that. It's like, whoa, you put a milestone down on design, wherever you're looking at design for whatever, you know, aspect of our world. Boom. That one right there is just like,
and this has nothing to do with revenue. I want people, you know, right? People like to look at numbers. It has nothing to do with revenue or success. I'm talking about to affect design culture, pop culture, to affect, you know, footwear in that way. That's really the metric at which you measure whether it's value, right? Like, listen, it's like an album comes out and at that very moment, you can't do certain things anymore. You need to view it in a different way. You know, the aperture opens up a little bit. And that's what Reebok continuously did. And not just in product, but in marketing and in affiliations with rap music and hip hop culture. Every time we stepped in a direction that others wouldn't, we grew the consciousness of our consumer, right? With every step, they understood and learned, oh, and it just grew and it grew. And it's like footwear, culture, music, basketball culture. How does that intersect with lifestyle? And we grew that consciousness. Maybe others understood that consciousness, had the resources to become successful revenue-wise and do other things, but we grew a consciousness that allowed for those types of strategies. Because before us, brands weren't working in that way. They weren't entrusting product, you know, to be pushed in, you know, pushed inside of a cultural message as opposed to athletic message.
Exactly.
That was a big risk.
All the brands, all the brands back then were just like, we are a sports brand. We do not acknowledge that. Even though Adidas had, like, you know, done a little foray with Run DMC, obviously, but then that when that came to pass, that was it. Reebok really, like, you know, provided that synergy and that dynamic where it, you know, it gave due reverence and it looked at the culture at large and was like, yes, we understand. We want to work with you. We want to make it happen.
We value you. Exactly. We value your ideas. We value your feedback. We want to incorporate you in the marketing of this product. We want to incorporate you in the messaging of this product, right? Yeah. Because before that, kids like me in the hood were purchasing and being involved with brands that didn't really want to affiliate. So we're contributing to their top line. You know, we're over here, you know, fueling the success of this brand and never really, you know, being recognized. Reebok, it was a little different. And that whole mentality shifted everything.
Exactly. It's like, if we give to you, you will give back to us. And then that means that we can be us, if that makes sense.
It was a conversation as opposed to a dictatorship. You know what I mean? It was a conversation as opposed to a delivery of here you go. It was more, hey, in exchange, you know.
Exactly. And Paul Fireman just giving Stephen Smith the green light, yo, just go all out, just do what you want. It was almost like a maestro conducting an orchestra. Because when you look at the Fury, you got the carbon fiber midfoot, you know, plate in play with the Hexalite, in play with the Reebok pump technology, and then part of the shoe has been taken away. It's like, what is he doing?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And, it, yeah. and he's right. And he was right.
Anyone else would have said, yeah. Anyone else would have just like, you know, thrown it out of the house. But Feynman was just like, give me more.
And I think that's it, right? There was this entrepreneurial kind of mindset that Paul Feynman brings and permeates the building and permeates what we are able to do. So somebody else that really, really is the beacon, I think, for designers that have come to the brand or people who love the brand now is E. Scott Morris. And John Morris, if you think about Mobius and you think about real performance language of Reebok and basketball in the mid-1990s, it undoubtedly was touched by those two designers. And designers today, like Xavier Jones, will talk about how those shoes spoke to him in Flint, Michigan, right, where he grew up. And it was a, hey, look, this has a different look and feel. And and I think we're benefiting from that today for sure, and Absolutely. Hopefully into the future.
There was such Absolutely. A confidence means, of it, yeah. right? It was such a confident design language. You know, yes. E. Scott is like, and I'm not talking about arrogance. I'm talking about confidence. I'm talking about he's ready to mm-hmm. to tackle the task. He's ready to push it further, right? Like there's mm-hmm. no, you know, he has that type of passionate outlook. So. You can see it in that stuff. Like, damn, like this, like, okay. Like mm-hmm. we are stepping in that direction and we're not tippy toeing. We're confident yep. and we're committing and let's go. And you can feel yes. it. You can feel it and you can see it. And I think that was a part of the success of it all.
No, absolutely. It was like Stephen Smith sort of punk rock attitude because, you know, he's a big punk rock dude. And probably that sort of like percolated through to the people that he was mentoring. And then boom, they're operating in that environment. Hey, what can we do? Where can we take it? Mm-hmm. You're only limited by your imagination now, mm-hmm. which is phenomenal to be given mm-hmm. carte blanche like that. And all these little instruments. You could even say that, you know, the pump was an instrument, the hex light was an instrument, you know, the ERS system was an instrument. And how do we make those instruments harmonious and make a new tune out of it? Mm-hmm. And then the footwear is kind of like a musical tune in some respects.
So mentioning that, E. Scott will talk about Mobius specifically. So we think all of the models in the Mobius collection, he said he wanted them to vibrate at a different wow. frequency. And I wow. think if you look at them all sitting together, they do that. And I would also say that he is so generous with his time. Mm-hmm. He archived everything he did at Reebok.
What?
For the whole time he was at Reebok. And
that's foresight, because how many brands were doing that at that time? Let's say
seriously.
None.
And then, so it was probably one of the greatest conversations I've had in my professional life. I can remember I was driving home and I got a phone call yeah. and it was E. Scott Morris. He was like, hello, Aaron. He's like, I've heard about the archive. He's like, I think I have something for you. Mm. And in the mail came seven boxes of footwear, of memorabilia, of conceptual design drawings, like wow. will blow your mind.
Okay, incredible.
Everything from outtakes with Emmett Smith and shoes drawn for Shaq or Venus Williams or any other performance athletes mm-hmm. we had at the time. And so that foresight, he has it. And that generosity of spirit and the understanding that he was in this place of privilege where he could pay it forward mm-hmm. to the designers today. Mm-hmm. It was an incredible opportunity to invite him to Reebok to talk with us about wow. his story and also have him connect with the young designers. He uh-huh. even when he signs with Reebok, he is actually deployed to the Gulf at the time. And he tells a story about how he wore the pump battleground and he just taped out the pump ball and he wore them during deployment. And
wow.
literally he has a G.I. Joe. So this is him. That's bulletproof. So you can look even on the back is yeah. his name and his kind of his life story. It's name Morris Earl S, Where is he from? Chicago. So he is just...
I need to find that G.I. Joe figure.
You can, I bet.
Yeah, look, I got figures in the back here, but I need that one. But anyway, that's a different story. Yeah.
And he's such a generous mentor. And I know Frank can talk about this as well. His spirit like is so positive. And just to be in his presence, like talk about a different frequency.
Wow.
Like,
the way you're channeling your emotions now when you're talking about him and the expression on your face, not that the listeners can see that, but it's like having that effect on you. And that's fantastic.
And I agree with everything she's saying, and I feel the same exact way. When I stand next to him, even if it's in a casual setting, even if we're not, trying to get into a work conversation or have some type of objective, just hanging with him, just the energy that he radiates is warm. It's useful, right? It's intentional. He's present, and he's down to share any experience, that will help you, get some perspective. And like Aaron said, so imagine having that, Evan, he's just like a magnet in that way, right? But also having the intellectual, prowess, like to catalog your life and understand all the motivations behind everything you've done and everything you've created, and be able to use that as a source when you are talking to someone like me, right? Who grew up in this game and who we only know what we know, right? We're one person, we hear what we hear, we come in contact with, it's like that's how we accumulate. But when you get near someone like that, suddenly, holy shit, like there is so much information.
Yeah.
And it's not berating you with it. It's not over my head. I mean, he puts it there, man. He puts it there and you soak it up, he's a great guy.
Well, that's it. You need great mentorship. You need people to convey the information and put everything into context in a way that people can assimilate and can empathize with and be entertained by. They have to be entertained. And then that's how you push things forward, having that fabric within a company is absolutely brilliant you guys can attest to how phenomenal everything that came out in that era was. It still reverberates to this day.
Even the stuff that didn't go crazy at retail or some more obscure stuff that Aaron has access to that's been archived, you look back at this stuff and you see the genius of it, like, man.
It could be appreciated now.
Yes. There's a lot of ways.
Yeah.
A lot of those big pushes, maybe possibly, shot too far, and they pulled it back for the retail version. Mm-hmm. And man, this is such a amazing, just archive of offshoots and rarities that you can see where their mind was at. They didn't want to settle. They were just forever trying to push it forward. Maybe
Jason, I need to get involved with that and see that, because the thing is, looking at the innovations that might have been too far forward, and can be appreciated now. Because I remember when Ian Paley had an exhibition at his garb store about 4 or 5 years ago, and there were some prototypes on display, and Nayakita was there as well. And I was talking to him and Ian, and I was going, what the hell was going on here with those shoes? Those look incredible. They've got to come out. You've got to do something about that. Do you know what I mean? So I'm hoping that you guys, I was mind blown. I was just like, whoa. And I was looking at, things that the Nike VaporMax, for example. I swear I saw an example of that type of shoe, appliance of that aesthetic within that, 4 or 5 years ago, with a prototype that dates back to I don't know when. Mm-hmm.
But this is what I'm talking. This is how I see it, right? This is how I see it. Where are you gentlemen from? Like, where are you right now?
Yes.
We're in London.
You're in London. So say you guys grew up in London, a bunch of guys grew up in London, maybe crosstown, you didn't really get in, but you kind of came up around the same thing, you're influenced by the same things, right? And you go off to different countries to do different things, right? To me, Reebok was a part of this collective consciousness, right? Where we shifted the way people seen, innovation and marketing and how we, connect with culture. And so these designers are human beings, man. If Xavier worked at Nike, he'd still be influenced by E. Scott Morris.
Absolutely.
And I think it's simply that as humans, as creatives, as designers, we absorb and we collect inspirations. And there's this collective consciousness. It's like a big ass lake. And we're just, you know what I mean? Right? And you're going to come up on a, oh shit, look at this Reebok thing here. Now it's in the consciousness. Now it's locked in the creative, you know what I mean? In the creative bank. And when you go on to do amazing things in your own right at Nike, it's okay. The remnants of these inspirations are coming through. You know what I'm saying? Whether conscious or not, or whether someone will admit to it or not, right? These ideas existed. They predate a lot of the things that are here. And it's okay in my book, you know?
Definitely. Yeah.
You're listening to Soulful Sneaker Stories, a Soho Radio original.
Well, someone else who had a huge impact at Reebok, who I've got to ask you about because he's still one of my favorite basketball players of all time, is Shaq. And Aaron, you mentioned him before. I mean, when Shaq came on the scene, I mean, he was like nothing. And he famously chose Reebok over Nike. Why do you think that was? Because for most players at that time, you would have kind of thought they would have gone for the safe option. But Shaq didn't. He went with you guys. Why do you think he did that?
So I can speculate, right? I think that Reebok also let him be who he was. So there was not any kind of narrowing or shortening of who Shaquille is as an individual, as a business person, as a musician, as an entertainer, we welcomed. So to Frank's point, we welcomed all of that, right? All of that to us. And we had the opportunity to be part of it. And I think that that's something that Reebok did really, really well at the time, right? Is that understand kind of the multiplicity of people. We see this happen with other athletes we work with, like Allen Iverson, Venus Williams. They have pursuits and passions that reach further than the court. And Reebok does that. We also have this amazing shoe, the Shaq Attack.
Yes. Right,
designed by Judy Close. And that shoe specifically, if you think about 1992, how it wraps the vector kind of around the shoe in a very fluid kind of dynamic appearance, this will also be a big departure from where we'd been before. Shaq is still the one person when I'm around, I like lose my shit. I don't know why. He's so friendly and so nice and so funny, right? Shaqed in a fool. But for me, it's just, there's something so charismatic about his persona and his presence that we're just, I feel lucky to.
I see how he is when he's doing some of the punditry, you know, on the NBA, broadcasts, and you just see how he comes across. I mean, him and Charles Barkley are two very interesting characters and very exuberant characters, shall we say. But Shaq, the way he carries himself, he's 300 pounds, isn't he? He was a 300 pound. He might be even more now because he's probably not, you know, keeping in shape as much. So he was 300 pounds, and to design a shoe, you know, that fit his, he had, what was his size feet? Was he 22? How big was his feet?
So when we first signed Shaq, he was a size 19.
Right.
And then what happened was every 6 months when they would do fast prototyping of, you know, player models for him, they would be too tight. Right. And so they would keep on taking molds of his feet to make the shoes. And he stopped at 22.
Wow.
So,
I mean, that's a colossal. It's like, it's like his feet.
It is like, it's like holding a 6 month old child in your hand. It's like this.
It's like there's dinosaur prints. There's going to, you know, people look at dinosaur prints in like, you know, 50,000 years. They'll see a print of Shaquille O'Neal's foot and they'll like go, oh, he must have existed around the same time as the dinosaurs because, you know, his footprint is that, like, you know, that dominant.
And his...
Yes, it's Jurassic. His footprint is Jurassic.
There'll be point of right. So Reebok will also make point of sale pieces for the, you know, different retailers. And for any kid who was, you know, alive in the 90s, right? This is something that's kind of part of your collective memory, right? Basketball as a in North America will reach its height of participation in the early 1990s, especially within kids. And this is equally distributed between boys and girls. So that kind of, you know, raising consciousness to basketball and someone who is larger than life and does have that charisma, I think for so many people, he was someone to really look up to. And like literally for all people, he's someone to look up to.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, I almost see it as, you know, the irony that maybe Nike wasn't big enough for Shaq. And Reebok was, you know what I'm saying? I think we were big enough in the way that we understood we got to let this man exist in his totality. That's the value of Shaq. If Shaq had the traditional, you know, very athletic, very, you know what I mean? Very narrow, right? Personality that came with being in sports at that era, right? Again, that it just connects back to pointing out that our innovations weren't just in product. This was an innovation of partnership strategies. This was an innovation in how brands work with athletes to let Shaq exist as big as he needed to exist. All it did was unite us in that way. All it did was empower everything that we did. And we needed someone like Shaq to sell a shoe that looks like Shaq Attack. That's not small potatoes. That's a very unique personality.
Yeah, he had to be the marquee ambassador, didn't he? Because in Nike, for example, he'd have been too congested. You know, you had your Jordan, you had your Barkley, you had your Pippen and so on and so forth. You know, Penny and everyone subsequently after. But with Reebok and the appliance of technology, which I'm sure he saw was like, yo, this can I can work with this. And, you know, being a fan, you know, he probably loved Dominic Wilkins, because Dominic was a power forward, right? Wasn't he a power forward? Shaq was a center, but, you know, whatever. It's like, you know, similar sort of build, et cetera. But many attributes where Shaq could shine with you guys and the philosophy behind you to see that and to not try to sculpt, not try to, you know, go, hey, we're signing you, but we want to make you a company guy. No, we don't want a company guy. We want you, to represent our company, which is a difference.
It's almost like we want to be in the Shaq business as opposed to you being the Reebok.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I heard a story once that when Shaq was kind of deciding between Reebok and Nike, you know, he went to you guys and, you know, pretty much everyone in the company turned out to kind of greet Shaq. Wow. And he just knew that was the place for him. But then his agent said, no, we still got to go and see the Nike presentation. But he was so sure about you guys that during the whole tour with Phil Knight, he wore a Reebok jacket. I mean, I don't know if that's apocryphal, but I would hope that it's true.
I think Shaq lives his life like he played his position on the court, right? You know, like he's making things happen. He's not allowing the things around him to shape him, right? That's what makes him Shaq. And I think that's what makes him powerful, you know? Erin, I know you wanted to say something.
No, I was going to say, and I think that power and that position continues today, right? So Shaq has a foundation. They do incredible work with young people, like in Boys and Girls Clubs across America. Mm-hmm. And I think that just speaks to his kind of steadfastness and his trueness to himself. He still DJs, right? DJ Diesel. You can check him out, right?
We record when it came out.
Oh, I have. I think I have a CD over
here. I think Lord Tariq and Peter Guns are on one of the tracks with him.
Yes, they are. His music was good. I think people sometimes don't want to measure it just on the value of the music because he's such a big personality somewhere else. But Come on, man. Like, yeah, he has songs of Wu-Tang, Mobb Deep, and, you know, and granted, they more sound like Wu-Tang, like a Wu-Tang song featuring Shaq and a Mobb Deep song. But that was the magic of it, man. Like, he went into their worlds and actually did, and performed. Right? Like, he went into, he was on the Wu-Tang song.
Yeah, that's right.
No Hooks, right? It was called No Hooks. You know, and it's like, and he's there and he's existing in it and he doesn't seem like he's faking or.
Because he loved it. He wanted to be in it.
And then it didn't work. He had a real passion for it. A real.
And I think the same for his acting. And now as a commentator for how long? He just think the other thing about Shaq is when you're with him, he's with you. Right. So you really get a sense of that engagement. And he, so working on a current project with him with the Human Rights Awards. Uh-huh. Yeah. So he sits on the board of Reebok's Human Rights award program to help.
As if the guy can't get any greater in my esteem. He's like, this guy keeps growing. It's fantastic. Yeah. And he's already 7 foot plus.
Well, if he stood on top of his accomplishments and his generosity, he'd be like fucking 300 feet tall. You know what I'm saying? Because this guy's, you know what I mean? Like, wow. He's forever, extending himself, you know, not just in profit, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like to make, but in humanity too. So I think that's what makes him special.
I still remember when I watched Men in Black and Will Smith, who's obviously had a great taste in sneakers for ever since day. And he's got the Shaqnosis on, hasn't he? And I was just like,
yep.
What are those? Because I think the shoes debuted in that film. Am I correct? Or did they debut on his feet and then Will Smith wore them in the film? I can't quite remember how it played out.
Yeah, I don't remember, but I do remember, you know what I mean? Seeing them. And to me, it was... To kind of point back to what we were saying earlier, it vibrates. It was vibrating on a different frequency, and it fit inside of this world, Men in Black, so flawlessly, right? Like there, you know, this is all intentional, right? Like what Will Smith was wearing, and it all fit inside the storyline. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And that shoe, it worked. Mm-hmm. And it almost, you know, we were pushing towards the future, right, with some of these designs, and it almost put it in the context of such, right? When you have aliens and technology, it almost was like, it's where it needs to be. You know what I mean? So that was a memorable moment.
Absolutely, yeah. The
that's it.
Yeah, these shoes work on court. They got one of the best basketball players of all time wearing that shoe.
Yeah,
and this whole Will Smith fighting aliens with pop that shoe
culture,
on.
Yeah, absolutely, you know, right. Value. Yeah. Like, yeah, this whole taking other it galactic. Global value. I mean, it was just really cool. You know, it that kind of cool. It just feels good. You know,
Reebok's always messed around with outer space. Because, Alien, you know, you take it back to Alien, right? What's Ripley wearing, right? And I've got those shoes. I got the replicas of those shoes up there, literally. And it's like one in the big box. Yeah. It's just like one of the dopest things. And
Alien Stompers.
What were they called?
The Alien Stomper.
The Bug Stomper? The Alien Stompers, Stomper. Right?
And so this DNA, you know, great, it's like shoe. Our shoes look great now and they look great in outer space and in the future. Do you know what I mean? I don't know many, you know, many people can say that. Do you know what I mean?
The stories that we can tell is just part of the greatest, you know, greatest resource that we have as a brand is that we had so many layered stories to tell, whether we were present in some type of pop culture moment or present in some type of, sports moment, right? Memorable sports accomplishment, you know, in music and we've been ever present in the most credible way.
Absolutely. I mean, it's phenomenal. The application of pump technology, we discussed the whole basketball thing. We touched on Michael Chang. Where else was it like permeating through, for our listeners? Cause you know, Jason, I know, but you know, we want to hear it from you guys, you know, where was it really successfully applied and people are still bugging out, you know, about that.
I don't know. I think you want to take this, Aaron? I don't know. I think for us,
go ahead.
Pump again was a part of these bigger brand moments, right? Where, when Blacktop came into play, right? When that whole,
yes.
Outdoor
and explain short. Blacktop so, to so our Blacktop, listeners.
And I don't know the year exactly, I don't want to, you know, but early 90s, 91, 92. Right. So 91, I'm 92, 13, yeah. Right? I'm 13. I'm in middle school, right? So around that time, there was a big push towards outdoor basketball, right? It was being featured in places. You're watching like, right. The show with Ahmad Rashad, I forget the basketball show, Inside the NBA, whatever it was, right? All these, things like Jordan posters where he's on a playground, like the playground component was really starting to make its way, right? Into marketing, into the way people view products. So there was an incredible opportunity to have like a relationship with this sport in a whole different way, right? And not just in terms of how we communicate with that consumer, because it's a whole different thing and it becomes, fun. And we got all these different ways to storytell, but the product had to sustain. The product had to work. You had to be able to really play ball on concrete or what have you, what I'm saying, on asphalt. So it was one of those moments where we plugged into this cultural vibration, right? And other brands did too. Adi had their version, the street ball and what have you.
But the street ball,
absolutely.
Nike came with the Air Raid, but I think Blacktop came out just a little bit before those.
And correct.
And Reebok looking at street basketball, when you're chatting with Bobito and everyone, it's, and the whole pickup game, et cetera, West 4th in New York and all that stuff. And how that,
Reebok was a part of that.
Careers,
And the stories. Yeah, Reebok was a part of that.
I don't think And One would have happened. Mm-hmm. And One might not have happened because of that. Mm-hmm. When we look at those sort of moments in history.
And it was a commercial success as well, right? So it was, the timing is definitely earlier. Street Ball will come out in 93, will be out in 91, 92. Mm-hmm. And in the first 4 months of being in market, we'll have 1.8 million pairs sold. Like, we're talking about capacities breached in our factories. Sinbad will become the spokesperson for Blacktop. It will win awards for the kind of commercials that Reebok was producing. And to Frank's point, this was a different way of marketing.
That's it. And by Sinbad, you
the
mean
comedian, the comedian. It goes by Sinbad.
And we'll go to where the sport is happening, right? So we'll do these vans kind of decked out for Blacktop, and we'll bring that activation to the court.
So you had a street team.
We definitely did.
So Reebok, sports company, had a street team. That's phenomenal.
Well, you got to think about it, right?
Definitely did. And those three.
Sorry, Aaron, to jump in, right? But in order to properly connect with that culture, you have to be on the street.
Yeah.
You can't do that shit from Canton,
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And the 3-on-3 tournaments will be taking off, right? And we even have some documentation of how did we talk about this, like in Europe, right? Tarmac. Like Blacktop refers to tarmac, where people play basketball. And this is also a very accessible way to play basketball. Like, what do you need, to play this sport when you're a kid? You need a court and a ball, right? And some people to play with. And to this day,
I'm sorry, Aaron. Yeah. That's the bigger thing.
It's the most accessible way to access all of that culture that you're discussing, right?
Totally.
Is by getting out and playing. And to this day, it still is, right? If there are courts where the lights can be on, where the rims are installed, then kids will find their way, and young people will find their way to a pickup game.
Or putting the hoop up on the garage or garage, as you Americans like to say. And then you got the concrete of the driveway. Do you know what I mean? You're doing, and you're playing, you're playing with your cousin like I did when I went on holiday.
It
takes it back to that.
And you're hoping the ball doesn't roll in the street. Sorry.
Flattened
by a car.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. With your boombox.
NBA culture was such at a fever pitch, right? But that is a professional sport. These athletes are the exceptions. These athletes are the chosen ones, right? And it's literally a lottery. It's like struck by lightning, get an NBA. It might be in the same category, right? So I think that Blacktop democratized it in a way. And we told the stories of the people who are just as exciting, who had just as much, even more personality on the court, because they're not in the confines of this league, environment, right? Like, there's such a creativity there. There's such a culture within itself, right? Moves. And I mean, it's the same energy that grew the music, right? That grew hip hop music. It's hip hop. It's hip hop. Hip hop is you know, hip hop is a filter. You know what I'm saying? Like and through the sport of hip hop, through the sport of a culture that was born in these playgrounds, you have such a texture and exciting, you know what I mean? Energy to this type of basketball. And then to bring it back to Sinbad, because he's significant, you know, he, at the time he was a prominent, you know, black comedian, right? Who was known for his opinions, known to be a bit eccentric, known to be, you know, unapologetic, right? You know, he wasn't reckless in any way.
Absolutely. And there weren't that many black comedians. No, there weren't that many black comedians. You know, you had Eddie Murphy, you know, prior to that, you had Richard
Pryor.
Sinbad
is one of the elites, you know. Sinbad was one of the elites. And the voice that he lent to Blacktop and really identifying that, you know, on the side of the court, that energy, right? And, you know, what's the equivalent, right, for football? Right, in your country, right, that energy, that sideline energy, that fever pitch, that shit talking, that he embodied that, and he presented it to the world. So it's almost like you know, you didn't have to go to New York, right, and make your way through those neighborhoods and connect, work your way through the crowd and get on the fence to see this happening. Reebok gave you a little bit of a glimpse of that, and I think that was very important. I think that was very forward thinking. And again, I think that and I'm not saying that it's responsible for all the other basketball, you know, street basketball messaging and product, you know, categories and other companies, but it grew the consciousness. Mm-hmm. So when someone else does it, it will be accepted even that much more, right? Because we went out and we blazed a trail.
Absolutely. Do you know what I mean? No, totally. I mean, talking about people blazing trails, you know, taking that street ball aesthetic, but applying it to the NBA, it's got to be Allen Iverson.
Yeah.
That attitude, you know, that swagger. You know, everyone talks about the double crossover on Jordan still to this day. You know what I mean? You know, have you guys worked with him? And you know, you know,
I mean,
whole relationship. Yeah.
How did that all begin?
How did it come to pass?
How did that all start?
What was the story behind that?
Well, listen, I Todd, right? Todd Krinsky is the master at breaking down the in and outs of the Iverson relationship. It is a layered thing, man. Like, right? It's to have someone with such personality and such spunk and such different new and different ways to do it. We have to figure out new and different ways to engage, right? So I'll let that be told, and I feel like that's been told. But I'll tell you what. If you equate him, right? If you look at America, you guys are looking at America right now, right? You are looking at us, and you can see the good and the bad. You can see the bullshit we're dealing with, that we're all dealing with, right? There are people who come from these environments that have survived. You know what I mean? Real environments, real tough circumstances, real systematic dysfunctions, right?
Absolutely.
To become these superheroes. Right? Michael Jordan came from here and landed here. He was a superhero and he accepted the godlike status. Give me that. Yes, I'm God. Yeah. And we believed him because he was doing such amazing
things. You needed inspirations. You needed people to look up to and go, hey, we can achieve.
Absolutely.
Because this guy has.
Iverson, in the way that Michael Jordan has endured and found his way, his life, right? Iverson's life, what he had to go through, right? The injustices in his life, the losses, right? For him to achieve the way he did, right? And then to be flawed the way he is, right? And let's just be real. It's the beautiful flaws of Iverson that make him who he is, right?
Yeah. The embodiment of humanity in an athlete.
Absolutely. In the good and the bad, the emotional things, right? Like there's a lot of this.
Emotional.
Absolutely. He was multidimensional. And that was the brilliance of Iverson. He doesn't hide any of that. Right.
Mm-hmm. Almost like you couldn't even have an athlete of his ilk right now with the whole homogenization of how you have to go through how many layers of PRs and all these kind of people and you have to conform to this. You know,
he didn't exist. In that way, you know. So you know, we got, again, being there and not messing something up. He was a special person. He had a special ability. He had a special story. You know, and he's come from the, you know, his arc in life was such a special thing. right? So when I see him and I see what we did with the product and what we, how we married that and how he had this, this attitude and this, and this feel that was more representative, you know, let me bring it back to when you talked about Adi and Run DMC, right? It, you know, and not, you know, Aaron, I know you're too young for this. So let me bore you for a few minutes. You know what I mean? But pre Run DMC, the most prominent rappers dressed more like R&B singers. They dressed more like Rick James, right? And it was just a part of, you know, there is how we look out here and when we're performing, right? Especially coming from the parts of the country, right? In the parts of the city that hip hop was born from, right? You want to represent aspiration. So you want to develop this character, right? And Run DMC came along, right? And were just themselves. They were a reflection of the people on the street.
Straight from the street, straight to the street to the stage.
There was no disconnect, right? It wasn't like, hey, wait a minute, you look like my, you look like the kids in my neighborhood. You should look like, you should be a little bit more, you know, prim and trim.
More flamboyant, maybe.
Yeah, for the job, you need a uniform, you need a costume.
Exactly. I'm why are you not dressing like Curtis Blow? Why are you not dressing like, you know, Melly Mel?
Absolutely.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Who are dudes, but, you know, they were dressed in a different way.
What did it do? It really connected in the most genuine way with a generation of kids, right? That see themselves and Run DMC. Now fast forward and use that same formula and equation for someone like Iverson. I think that there was such an emotional connection to his story and who he is and what he's endured, that there's a generation, continues to be generations of kids who see themselves in more of an Iverson than maybe someone else who is, you know, and I'm doing, I know this is audio, so I'm doing quotations with my fingers, right? Less flawed, right? And the God of this, or the king of that, or the best of this, or the greatest of all that. Iverson is special because we can see ourselves in, you know, in him, in his experiences. And then for him to achieve out of all that, it's even more beautiful. So
It's incredible, because that sort of story for me, you know, starts off with, say, you know, your footballers who always are wayward footballers like George Best and all that lot, you know, going through to McEnroe, going through to Agassi, the bad boy. This is the bad boy. And Iverson is the bad boy. You know what I mean? But thriving off that to, you know, to propel, to, you know, to get out of that situation and do that. But his shoes, his shoes.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my days. The question and the answer. Ain't that right, Jace?
Oh, yeah. I mean, for me, they kind of define that whole time. Yeah. You know, there aren't many other shoes that kind of come straight to mind for me around that time.
No, exactly. Yeah.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Evan.
No, I was just going to say, and the technology that will evolve on them. So we have VizHex. We talked about Hexlite before.
Yes.
We'll see the VizHex. And really, they're just two, the question and the answer, they become these two legacy lines of footwear, right?
Yeah.
In basketball. And there are a few models that kind of have the stories to tell like they do. And it's incredible to kind of see how he as a player, he as a person have touched like the whole world.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been to Beijing with Alan, Mr. Iverson, that's what I'll call him, right? And I've seen young people who weren't born before he started playing, like wrapping themselves in American flags, holding albums filled with his picture. And it's because he is who he is, right? He is undoubtedly Allen Iverson. And for so many people, the freedom they see in him being that the person he is provides them with a little space.
Absolutely.
To show themselves.
Yeah. I mean, going back to what Frank said, I mean, Allen Iverson was the hip-hop athlete. Right, cornrows, tats, attitude.
Maybe the first
fighting
maybe
for
the
his
first,
position.
The first hip hop.
That's the first. Yeah, he was the first.
Yeah. I'm just going
fine
off,
for it.
Yeah,
I'm riffing right now, and I think he was the first. Looking back, you know, I can't.
And he was punished for it, like Aaron just said. He was fined for it. You know, you can't do this. You can't wear that. And it was, you know, it was it was a restriction that someone had to blaze against, someone had to push against in order to grow the consciousness of even the NBA. Now you look at the NBA now and it's a total reflection of post-Iverson.
Yeah.
You know, post-Iverson, people can be who they want to be.
Exactly. Well met.
Didn't
piece,
the NBA change the rules?
Yeah.
Didn't they have to tighten up the rules on what players wore off court because they were so upset.
Listen, it was, and if you think of it, not to get all heavy, but it think about it, man. Think about it in terms of like the parallels of the justice system and all that, right? It's like, let's tighten the policies to make sure that we restrict, you know, these, you know, a set of people from prospering, right? Let's build new reasons why people are wrong, or build new reasons why people have new rules to break in order to, you know, keep you confined, right? So
keep you in line with white America. Can I say that?
But it permeates, from the UK
saying that.
Yeah, but it permeates other sports, right? Like tennis. Like how much of what you wear in tennis has to be the color white, right? And the percentages and like finding players to do that. That hasn't. Last I checked, that hasn't stopped really, still makes it into the news. So the structures and the systems in play do not allow for the individualism that's brought. And that's why those structures need to, and systems have to be changed. And in some cases dismantled,
you know,
you know, go ahead.
To me, that's the core of who we are. In essence, right? Because we did not sit down when we achieved, hey, look at this innovation, look at this product innovation. We can, you know, we always pushed forward. We pushed forward. We resisted the resistance, right? of trying to move forward and try to do things differently. And I think that was in our DNA all the way down to partnering with an Iverson in empowering him to help change those inequalities, in the league that he was dominating in. So imagine to be such a dominant player and still have all these additional judgments. And it's not about the sport at hand. It's about the person and the way that person is reflecting his individuality inside of the sport. That's colonialism, man.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, one thing I've just picked up from what you're saying there, and one thing I've thought is that Reebok as a brand didn't celebrate, you know, Black History Month. It celebrated Black history, if that makes any sense, right? And the thing is, you didn't make a conscious attempt to go, hey, this is a Black History Month shoe. We're celebrating like that. You guys actively just did what you did. Whereas other brands had to like now be a bit more, hey, oh, this is something we can do. Well, for whatever reasons why, but I think Reebok was pioneer in that regard. Yeah. So, you know, when you look at it.
And I would definitely say that has a lot to do with the leadership Reebok had at the time. So Paul Fireman himself as an individual and his own personal background, Angel Martinez, just different players that understood what it was like to have a different lived experience, a different origin story, right? And to bring that to Reebok and then understand the kind of impact Reebok could have globally, it allowed that aperture to open for the Shaqs and the Allen Iversons and the Venus Williams to really opening the doors.
Mm-hmm. The doors keep on getting closed. Well, we're not about that. We want to open the doors.
Yeah. And I would say they'll also make decisions like a lifetime contract, right? With AI or Venus Williams awarding her the highest endorsement deal at the time.
Yes.
And that will create change. In ways that maybe we don't think about, but to this day, women's tennis is still the highest paid sport in the world. And Mia Hamm went to Nike the year after to renegotiate her contract based on what Venus did with Reebok. And I think that to me makes me proud of this brand's heritage and legacy. Not perfect, not perfect at all.
Another innovation. You just point out another innovation.
Yeah. That's it. Yeah, it's about innovating. It's about innovating the way that you engage with your you know, your demographic, the people who appreciate Reebok, how you grow that, the athletes that you innovate with, and the innovation of technology as well. Mm-hmm. You know, and how all of those sort of elements are in play, which is fantastic. You know, ERS, Hexalite's a mad one because I don't know who invented it, and please interject at some point with that. I think Jace probably knows because he studied that in Golden Kicks book. which I need to reread again, obviously. Sorry, dude. I mean, it goes in one area, the other sometimes. But it's like the application of honeycomb, like the structure of like honeybees and the honeycomb, and applying that. It's just like genius.
It's such a unique,
and bees invented it, look. But we rediscovered it.
Such, it's yeah. such a unique look on product. Again, another moment of how do we push this forward? You know, because it's really interesting. It's unique. There's nothing really like that. Mm. You know, and then the structural benefits and the design benefits and all that is again. But like Clark said, if it doesn't look good, no one's gonna really care. It doesn't exactly. really. You know, the that's innovation it. Is nothing without the vehicle of having something that's well designed and you know what I mean. Exactly. It's something that can fit inside of the world, right? It's like, you know, how does that's this it. Fit in my life? Oh, you know what? It does. It's unique and different, but it fits. I can use that. Totally. So when I look at that hex light window, even on the questions, when I first, yeah. you know, when they came out, when the very first time I held that shoe in my hand, it was like unique. It was like, what is going on here? You know what I mean?
I know. That's the one thing about Reebok. It's like shoes generally these days are looking a little bit more androgynous, should we say, a little bit like trying to, if you hold up a silhouette of one foot, of one brand to another, it's a bit the design DNA.
Yeah,
you know, it's not as expressive, it's not as dynamic. It's the points of difference. Reebok shoes, right? Reebok shoes all the way through. You can tell a Reebok shoe. It doesn't matter if it's completely mm-hmm. different in aesthetics to another shoe. That's Reebok.
Yeah.
You just know it.
Yeah.
And that's so hard to achieve and encapsulate.
You know, Miles Davis, right? People reference him as would be the greatest jazz man of all time, right? Mm. But during the time when he was dropping these albums, every album was way, way more different than the last, right? So in retrospect, we celebrate, oh, Miles Davis, he's the king or whatever. But during, right, he would be successful at one thing and then throw that formula out the window. And do this next album and throw that formula out there. Hey, flamenco music, let's go and throw that shit out the window and work his way into the 80s, right? And every album was this different version of him pushing it forward. I kind of see Reebok in that way. You know, I think
that,
you know, we would find success
definitely.
In a particular design language, but we didn't overstay our welcome sometimes. We moved on and blazed in a different direction. You know, and if the pump series looks like this and has been successful, and then we jot over here with the next concept and Mobius is over here and this is over here. I think that those commitments to push forward into directions that haven't been, you know, previous, that's what made us special. You know, and looking back, it looks more intentional. It looks, you guys, you know, but at the time these were risks. You know,
you're trying it. You're just trying it. It's like Fleetwood Mac. Fleetwood Mac's another one. I watched the Fleetwood Mac documentary and I was like, hold on a sec. Their sound changed all the way. Different members came in and out of the band, etc. And he's just like, whoa, became one of the biggest bands in the world.
It. And just like, okay, not defined by one sound, right? Not defined by one sound.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's exactly. Reebok. And when you have people like E. Scott Morris in the building, right? You can't help but do that. You can't help but continue to push things forward. We'll see later how it affects the culture looking back, right? But with people like E. Scott, that's how these things happen, you know?
That's it.
Yeah. And I think Reebok is that prolific because we've allowed people to bring themselves to the brand and that we are not the brand. The brand doesn't wear you, you wear it. Right. Absolutely. So to Frank's point that the people like E. Scott, like all the designers, those creatives, they could bring themselves to this brand and make something unique and different that will resonate with consumers. And that to me, in my mind, is the elasticity of Reebok as a concept, as a place. It is going to be those clean classic shoes that we think of today, but it will also be something that will keep our eye to the future.
Oh, absolutely.
Listen, who else would be so confident in a brand and be so confident in this forward thinking design that he'd actually wear the product in war? You know what I'm saying? He went to war wearing Reeboks.
That's a whole story you, know you guys
mean?
Have got to
I mean, what else
follow up on, because
we could do a whole episode.
I wasn't aware of this, I think that's a big look. That really is a big look. You know what I mean? You know,
and please don't take it as like this. You know, to me, it's in such a creative way he looked at it as something that would be useful. He's not some military-esque guy or someone that you meet and it's like he's into law enforcement and guns. No. It was purely like design and utility. You know, he sees things that we don't. That's what designers, they see things. Designers are solving for things that we don't even know they're solving for. They see the future. They're solving problems we don't know exist yet. And I think that E. Scott Morris was a vehicle for those future solutions, you know?
Oh, man. Yeah, that is deep. That is deep. One thing we've been talking about is the whole music aspect of how Reebok is like, you know, had so much synergy within, you know, and moving things forward. And, you know, Jason and I were chatting about this earlier, but, you know, taking the what sort of started off with what started off with Run DMC, wasn't it, Jace?
Yeah, I mean, I guess you can argue in a way that that was a bit of a one-off, you know, Addy and Run DMC, and it's, you know, we're still feeling the waves, but I kind of feel that, you know, when you guys kind of turned your attention to music, that was where suddenly something big happened. But I mean, what kind of led to that? Why did Reebok suddenly decide, you know, to make that bold move?
You know, I think that if you look at all the decisions leading up to those types of transitional moments, we've always been working our way in that direction. We've always shown that the athlete's story isn't the only story, right? We wanted to be present in our consumers' communities, like Blacktop, right? Blacktop is a reflection of being present inside of a community. So when you're present inside of these communities, when you're in tune with the consumer and in tune with the most dominant culture in the world, right? As in, you know, in hip hop, right? You can see how we were already stepping in that direction in the most honest way, in lockstep, basically, right? It wasn't, you know, not to deflate the value of the Run DMC. That is invaluable. That is the beginning of everything when it comes to the convergence of, like, you know, footwear and fashion and music. It was an amazing moment. But Run DMC was a tidal wave that crashed Adidas's head. You know what I mean? It was such a major force that they couldn't ignore it. You know what I'm saying? And when Run announced into the audience, hey, throw your Adidas up, and everybody, because of the note, went like this.
Yep.
I mean, come on, man. It writes itself. So there, if you're not, I mean, come on, man. The universe is knocking you over the head. So thank you for accepting that big knock over the head. What we were doing was more nuanced. What we were doing, obviously, that was the moment it all started on, because they were the exception and they were such a huge global influence Run DMC, but it was kind of like a one-off. Yeah. What we were doing was being present inside of a community, being active inside of a community. So we began to grow those relationships.
Right.
We seen how culture and music affected, you know, sneaker culture and sneaker, the affinity for sneakers comes through music. Right, even for athletes, you see the NBA. Yeah. It might as well be
how are they practicing. What are they practicing in? What's like vibing them up in? You know, when they're training.
That's it.
The music.
So let's be there in a real way. You know, so when you see situations with, like, you know, 50 Cent, right? Think about 50. I mean, you guys know. I mean, everyone knows he's such a pop culture icon now, but he didn't have a squeaky clean, you know, lead up. He was just shot. Nope. There was attempted murder on his life. His music reflected those harshnesses. His opinions were very sharp and jagged, but he was ambitious and he was magnetic, right? And he was extremely talented, you know, not only as an entertainer, but as a businessman. So he took that personality and it was such a package. It's like G-Unit. It was like a punch in the face, right? It's like that G was like that, you know, punch in the face, right? Yeah. You know, you see a partnership between Reebok and like a 50 Cent or Reebok and a Jay-Z, you got to see the nuance. You got to see the fantastic arrangement of variables, right? You got to see like Reebok's willingness to let go of some of the vision to allow. Listen, you don't work with 50 or work with Jay-Z and think that they're here right? To just nod at the boards that we create for them.
No,
that's not how it's going down with these guys. These guys built empires and businesses.
They got, because they got opinions. They got knowledge.
They're in there. They understand what they want to represent. So those were those moments where we valued the musician, the hip hop artist, as much as others would value the elite athlete. And that was the dynamic. And with that dynamic, you get this magic.
Yeah, absolutely. And that magic is in key, because I remember getting the Reebok S. Carter album, S. Carter remix album, when it dropped, which was a promotional giveaway with the shoes. And I actually thought that version that Just Blaze, I think, produced in its entirety was actually better than the Black album. And I will put, and I've just said that, and I've always thought that the versions that Just, because Just Blaze is one of my favorite producers of all time, right? And his, the energy that he gives, you know, to everybody. You know, I remember watching the Beastie Boys once, and Mixmaster Mike was cutting up, and you know, I think Mike D or Ad Rock or whatever, or MCA, rest in peace, was just like Just Blaze, like that. They started rapping over Just Blaze beats, like that. They knew that's then that's a cosign in itself. And I just remember like going, wow, Reebok have just put out an album. That's not Def Jam, right? Def Jam didn't do it. Rockefeller didn't do it.
I mean, just think of the
original album. And the original album is one of the best albums that Jay-Z's ever put out.
Just think of the absurdity, right? Like, think of it as other brands, other marketing teams that are more traditional, you know, Mad Men, you know what I mean? Smoking indoors and shit. For, you know, looking at this going, what the hell is going over there? Such a risk. Such a volatile culture. And I'm saying it from the perspective of people trying to, companies trying to be safe, right? Like, there is so many variables there that we can't understand that. We're afraid. And Reebok wasn't afraid. Wasn't afraid to engage, wasn't afraid to empower. And I think with those moments of engagement, right? In that kind of way, I mean, you know, the S-Dog Carter, come on, man. I mean, how many units? I mean, it was such a ridiculous stat, right? Attached to that drop, you know?
And yeah, it becomes the fastest selling Reebok
of all time. Jay-Z never played a minute of sports in that shoe. And it's the fastest selling Reebok. Think of that, you know?
No,
it's that convergence, it's I think, that you're discussing.
It
converges in the 2000s, like where you can take inspiration from in athletics and in footwear and sneakers, right? It all converges to this.
I mean, think about the symbolism behind the inspiration. Think about another company that would be comfortable enough to do that. They're referencing a high-end shoe. Right. I mean, almost to a T, because Jay-Z and I spoke to Clark about this. Like, we've had a couple conversations about this. Right. They were unapologetic in their inspiration. They knew that that shoe had value to their lives in the context of what they've done.
Yeah. I mean, you know, when they were growing up, they couldn't afford the Gucci's because they were like, well, I still can't afford the Gucci's. But anyway, that's a whole other story.
Well,
right?
You know what?
Like, you know, you're looking at it.
So I'll do one edit there, because absolutely, I think the consumer probably feels that way. But for Jay-Z and Clark and that generation, it was different. They actually wore the Gucci and bought the Gucci. And I believe Clark, Clark is like, and I say this in the most respectful, there's nothing silly about, I take Forrest Gump seriously. Yeah. Clark is like the Forrest Gump of rap, because he's been at these amazing milestone moments all through. It's history. It's like, you were there.
Yeah.
And so Clark was very much there. When that Gucci shoe hit the shelves, he was there.
But he was an entrepreneur. Yeah. Clark was an entrepreneur because he was doing their new music seminar battles.
Yep.
So he was doing the DJ battles with his Supermen guys. Yep. I mean, I remember that. You know, and versus the X-Men, which became the Executioners. But I remember my friends going to New York, going to the NMS and going boom, because they had their rap careers and they were pushing forward in that. And Clark was an entrepreneur. Another guy who was around at the time who was part of those milestones is Kay Slay. No one, you know, if you go all the way back, you see Kay Slay everywhere.
Yeah.
And
legendary
Clark can iterate that. Yeah, exactly. That's exactly it, right? So when you say about Clark and one of the guys who's a bastion of hip hop culture, even to this day, You know him, I know him. He's a good friend, and it's fantastic to see what he's doing and what he talks and how he talks about things with due reverence.
Yeah.
It's phenomenal. And imparting that knowledge on other people. But yeah, you're right. He had the shoes.
Yeah, he had
Jay-Z
the shoes.
Jay-Z probably had the shoes because for other reasons, because I know a few people like that. Right?
It's a guarantee through Clark's stories that they had the shoe when it came out and it was unheard of. Yeah. Who was spending that amount of money on this shoe that's made for tennis that is out of context? You know, when you look, when we look back at the era, we think it's fantastic. When it's the first time you're looking at something, it's like, what's going on here? They had the foresight. Jay-Z, Clark, and their whole crew, they were wearing the... So when you fast forward and you see their partnership with a Reebok and the way they're doing it, the way they're infusing the music and Just Blaze, and the way they unapologetically point back to an inspiration that in context fits inside of like a drug dealer lifestyle, right? Right. But exactly. The storytelling and the emotion, we were allowed to pull from that, extract from that, and create this thing with Jay-Z that was historical. Yes. And it had nothing to do with sports. That is the part that is, really fascinating.
Exactly. You know? And you know what's interesting as well is the fact that Jay-Z took that shoe and just made their own version of it with you guys with Reebok. You can almost argue that when Virgil Abloh is designing his Louis Vuittons and he's taking inspiration from Avia's, you guys were there first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, listen again.
And you allowed that. Yeah. That
Reebok also owned Avia for a period of time.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, man. Oh, yeah. Really? You guys need to re-own them because they've got some great stuff they need to put back. That's a whole other story.
Yeah. But it's another example of, you know, when we break that wall, when we grow that consciousness, when we make that first step that people might not understand in the development of Estar Carter, but you see how that step has affected so much moving forward, you know.
That's it. But, you know, that whole conversation around that. One thing that I've got to say, so it's pretty much coming up pretty soon to the anniversary of those shoes coming out. So I'm hoping, without you guys confirming or denying it, it's up to you, obviously, but hopefully it'll be great if you commemorate that. It really would be.
Which one, the S-Dark Carter?
Bring them both out. Bring the G-Units out and bring the S-Carters out. Yeah. You can't have the story without the, you can't have, you know, the book without the front cover or the back cover and everything in between. Yeah. It has to be the complete thing.
Yeah. Really does. Listen, it would be something, but it would take an incredible feat to align. That was such a moment in magic and in time. Yeah. Everyone's in so many different places and their brands have evolved and it would take a feat. And I think that it's probably best that way. I think that it was and what it meant, and obviously I love reissue, but man, it was such a moment. Yeah. It was such a moment. You know what I mean? So let's not interrupt it. You know what I mean?
Well, maybe, but then
let's not fuck with it. I think Jace agrees. He's like...
I'm thinking more that Jay is now, he's now with a different brand, so that might be a bit difficult to
but you know
do,
what but... I mean even
that's Jay, not S. Carter though.
Yeah, but even without
this
that
alter ego.
Even without that snag of him being affiliated, it's more about times have changed, right? To commemorate such a shoe at such a time and such a moment today, it has layers, the inspirations, the stories that would resonate different today. It's a moment. It was an amazing moment.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And I'm pretty sure that, so Jay being an incredible businessman, he owns the originals, right?
Yeah.
So thinking about I am pretty sure when I say this, thinking about the design, I'm pretty confident that design is in his intellectual.
His
property.
Home, man. You don't listen, man.
The one thing I've learned from this conversation is Reebok doesn't take no for an answer, right? Reebok is bolshy. You're tenacious. You don't give a damn. We're gonna get it done, right? That's what I've learned. I mean, everything from Paul Fireman all the way down, even to J.W.
Fish, are you available to talk with our legal department? At any time, we'll bring you in.
I will break it down.
You can be counsel for us.
I can talk in legal terms. I'm just like, whatever it takes to make it happen, if it's possible, because we live in an era where so many kids are now looking back at the shoes that we grew up with a due reverence and just going, oh my gosh, I wish I could own them. And then sewing companies are bringing them back. They're going through whatever. Maybe they got a deeper way of accessing or whatever to make things happen. But I just putting it out there.
Yeah, no, you know? I listen, man.
We appreciate.
We can be drinkers.
It's incredible that we've had such a list of product that's resonated in such ways, right? Like that's just another, exactly. You know. Look at us. We're here romanticizing a shoe that came out so long ago. You know, right. That means something mm-hmm. to occupy that kind of space in someone's, you know what I mean? In someone's life and someone's story. Yeah. That's really cool. And I think that is at the core of Reebok. You know, we connect with a lot of people in a lot of different ways. We've pushed things forward and you can see us in other places. You can see us in other brands. You can see us, the attitude. And that's what made us special. You know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. Definitely. You know what I mean? Well, I think that's a great way to leave it, don't you think, Jace?
I was just going to say, Kish, I think that's a great
way to... We've got to get these guys back and we've got to talk about
exactly.
post-G unit. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Exactly. We've only got through part of the story yet again. I think we're going to have to get you guys back for season
'cause I'm just in the new Reeboks that are just dropping with Brain Dead and everything, right? And I'm just like, you know... They look incredible, but that's a whole other story.
No, we got an incredible team internally working on those partnership mm-hmm. projects. I mean, we got the best of the best working on those projects. Yeah. Amazing stuff.
And the reserve stuff that you're bringing out.
Yeah, and the reserve stuff too. Amazing stuff. That's the thing, man. Like I said, Charlie Parker said, right? Like it looks like magic. It hits the shelf. It's great. But the work, man, it took some work. It took some intention. And it took great people to see it through. So big shouts to everybody back in the company, you know.
Yeah, and that's the best thing about Reebok, definitely, is always been the people who bring this brand to life.
The people. Absolutely. It's the people. Definitely. Reebok is about the people. You know, for me, when I'm there, for us, when we look back at the history, it's all always been about the people.
Oh, well, thank you very much to you people for you know, hopefully inspiring our people.
I appreciate the invite. Sure. Thank you. You know, I hold you guys in high regard. I don't really have these conversations often. I've tried to sneak away from you know, these things. So it's always fun to talk to some folks that you know, have an appreciation for these things. So thank you. Great conversation. I appreciate it.
Great. It's been an absolute pleasure for us and an honor to speak to you, Frank, as well, because Kish and I are both big fans and, you know, we love everything you've
made
done
one
in
of
the
my
past
best,
and some of those
you've
collabs.
Made one of my favorite Adidas forums.
Oh, man. I love that shirt.
Which I got next door, literally in the hallway. And I can't wear them because they're half a size too small. Ooh. But I got the burgundy joints. And you know what I loved is because you put the crest on the side. And I remember did I buy them? But my friend bought them. But I remember the whole golf range back in the late 80s, early 90s that Adidas did, and the whole Crest series as well. Fila did a little bit as well with the whole Crest thing. Yeah. But I remember the Adidas that came out with the Crest. Yeah,
it was a reflection of all that. It was the Crest, right, exactly. You know, Troop and all these brands and things were happening.
Yeah,
and, you know, and it's like almost
British
that tennis
Knights,
language, you know, and it's made its way.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, listen, man, I thank you. I really appreciate that you guys, you know, even know about the things I've done. It's been a pleasure, man. I've been blessed, you know, and so I appreciate it. And it's been a pleasure speaking to you guys.
Well, thank you, Frank. And Aaron, thanks again for coming back. As I said, I think you're going to win another legion of fans from this episode. So
yeah, this is definitely so much fun. I'm really glad that Frank could join.
Always a pleasure, E.
Peace and love.
Okay,
peace,
cheers, guys.
Peace and love.
Thank you. Bye.
Jace, dude, I mean, we were expecting a conversation, right? But that went deep.
God. Wasn't it? I mean, the stuff we covered there, even I didn't think we were going to be going into before this episode. So that was some brilliant stuff. I hope the listeners love that because there's some knowledge there about Reebok history, which I've never heard anywhere else. I've never read anywhere else. So yeah, that was a treat.
Absolutely. You know what I mean? So yeah. Well, I think we're definitely setting the standards really high for the rest of the series. So it's going to be exciting stuff indeed.
Definitely. Absolutely. So sadly, that's it for another episode, everyone. Thanks for listening as always. And remember to send your comments and questions to us on Twitter or Instagram at soulful_podcast. Don't forget to subscribe. And if you like the podcast, please do leave us a review.
Indeed. And just so you know, this has been a Soho Radio Originals production. And we're going to see you next time. All right. Peace out.